I tried to quit before. I did quit. This station I was on had a program. You'd quit, they'd give you a job. One of their workers hauled me in and cleaned me up and told me the deal. The job was crap. The deal was bullshit. But I'd had enough. I thought I'd had enough.
How long did you last?
Not quite 6 months.
You see, I said after a 2 second pause, why I don't exactly have confidence in you this time?
Believe me, I do, but this is different.
She leaned forward, earnest.
Nothing quite clarifies your thoughts like thinking you're about to die.
The effect is often temporary.
They said, back on that station, that they could give me something to make Kef never work on me. But first, I had to fix whatever had made me take it to begin with, because otherwise I'd just find something else. Bullshit, like I said. But if I'd really wanted to, really meant to, I'd have done it then.
Back at Striegen's, she'd spoken as though her reason for starting was simple, clear-cut.
Did you tell them why you started?
She didn't answer.
Did you tell them who you were?
Of course not. The two questions were the same in her mind, I guessed.
You faced death back at Garsed.
She flinched, just slightly.
And everything changed. I woke up and all I had was past. Not a very good past, either. No one liked telling me what had happened. Everyone was so polite and cheerful, and it was all fake. And I couldn't see any kind of future.
Listen. She leaned forward, earnest, breathing slightly harder.
You're out here on your own, all by yourself, and obviously it's because you're suited to it, or you wouldn't have been assigned.
She paused a moment, maybe considering that issue of just who was suited to what, who was assigned where, and dismissing it.
But in the end, you can go back to the Roch and find people who know you, people who remember you, personally, a place where you fit, even if you're not always there. No matter where you go, you're still part of the pattern. Even if you never go back, you always know it's there. But when they opened that suspension pod, anyone who ever had any personal interest in me was already 700 years dead, probably longer. Not even...
Her voice trembled and she stopped, staring ahead at some fixed point beyond me.
Even the ships...
Even the ships.
Ships? More than just Sword of Naphtas? The first ship I ever served on, Justice of Torin. I thought maybe if I could find where it was stationed, I could send a message and...
She made a negating gesture, wiping out the rest of that sentence.
It disappeared. About 10... Wait, I've lost track of time. About 15 years ago.
Closer to 20.
Nobody could tell me what happened. Nobody knows.
Were any of the ships you served on particularly fond of you? I asked, voice carefully even, neutral. She blinked, straightened.
That's an odd question. Do you have any experience with ships?
Yes, I said, actually.
Ships are always attached to their captains.
Not like they used to be. Not like when some ships had gone mad on the deaths of their captains. That had been long, long ago. And even so, they have favorites. Though a favorite wouldn't necessarily know it. But it doesn't matter, does it? Ships aren't people, and they're made to serve you. To be attached, as you put it.
Savardin frowned. Now you're angry. You're very good at hiding it, but you're angry.
Do you grieve for your ships, I asked, because they're dead, or because their loss means they aren't here to make you feel connected and cared about? Silence.
Or do you think those are the same thing?
Still no answer. I'll answer my own question. You were never a favorite of any of the ships you served on. You don't believe it's possible for a ship to have favorites. Savardin's eyes widened. Maybe surprise, maybe something else.
You know me too well for me to believe you aren't here because of me. I've thought so from the moment I actually started thinking about it.
Not too long ago, then, I said. She ignored what I had just said.
You're the first person since that pod opened to feel familiar. Like I recognize you. Like you recognize me. I don't know why that is.
I knew, of course, but this wasn't the moment to say so, to explain, immobilized and vulnerable as I was. I assure you, I'm not here because of you. I'm here on my own personal business.
You jumped off that bridge for me.
And I'm not going to be your reason for quitting Kef. I take no responsibility for you. You're going to have to do that yourself, if you really are going to do that.
You jumped off that bridge for me. That had to be a 3-kilometer drop. Higher. That's...
She stopped, shaking her head.
I'm staying with you.
I closed my eyes. The moment I even think you're going to steal from me again, I will break both your legs and leave you there, and it will be utter coincidence if you ever see me again. Except that to Radchai there were no coincidences.
I can't really argue with that.
I don't recommend it. She gave a short laugh and then was silent for 15 seconds.
Tell me then, Breck, she said after that. If you're here on personal business and nothing at all to do with me, why do you have one of the Garcetti guns in your pack?
The correctives held my arms and legs completely immobile. I couldn't even get my shoulders off the bed. The doctor came heavily into the room, pale face flushed.
Lie still, she admonished, and then turned to Savardin. What did you do?
This was apparently comprehensible to Savardin. She spread her hands in a helpless gesture.
Not,
she replied vehemently in the same language. The doctor frowned, pointed at Savardin, one finger out. Savardin straightened, indignant at the gesture, which was much ruder to a Radchai than it was here.
You bother, the doctor said sternly. You go.
Then she turned to me.
You will lie still and heal properly.
Yes, doctor. I subsided from the very small amount of movement I had managed, took a breath, attempting to calm myself. This seemed to mollify her. She watched me a moment, doubtless seeing my heart rate, my breathing.
If you can't settle, I can give you medication.
An offer, a question, a threat.
I can make him,
with a glance at Savardin, leave.
I don't need it.
Either one. The doctor gave a skeptical humph and turned and left the room.
I'm sorry, said Savardin when the doctor was gone. That was stupid. I should have thought before I spoke.
I didn't answer.
When we got to the bottom,
she continued, as though it was logically connected to what she had said before,
you were unconscious and obviously badly injured, and I was afraid to move you much because I couldn't see if maybe bones were broken. I didn't have any way to call for help, but I thought maybe you had something I could use to help climb out, or maybe some first aid correctives I could use. But of course that was foolish. Your armor was still up, which was how I knew you were still alive. I did take your handheld out of your coat, but there was no signal. I had to climb up to the top before I could reach anyone. When I got back, your armor was down, and I was afraid you were dead. Everything's still in there.
If the gun is gone, I said, voice calm and neutral, I won't just break your legs.
It's there, she insisted. But this can't possibly be personal business, can it?
It's personal. It was just that with me, personal affected a great many others. But how could I explain that without revealing more than I wanted to just now?
Tell me.
This wasn't a good time, not a good moment. But there was a great deal to explain, especially since Savardin's knowledge of the past 1,000 years of history was sure to be patchy and superficial. Years of previous events leading up to this, which she would almost certainly be ignorant of, which would take time to explain before I ever got to who I was and what I intended. And that history would make a difference. Without understanding it, how could Savardin understand anything? Without that context, how could she understand why anyone had acted as they did? If Anandar Mianai hadn't reacted with such fury to the Garcetti, would she have done the things she'd done in the 1,000 years since? If Lieutenant On had never heard of the events at Ime 5 years before, 25 years ago now, would she have acted as she did? When I imagined it, the moment that Mercy of Sarsa soldier had chosen to defy her orders, I saw her as a segment of an ancillary unit. She had been number one of Mercy of Sarsa's Amat unit, its senior member. Even though she had been human, had had a name beyond her place on her ship, beyond Mercy of Sarsa 1 Amat 1. But I had never seen a recording, had never seen her face. She had been human. She had endured events at Ime. Perhaps even enforced the corrupt dictates of the governor herself when ordered. But something about that particular moment had changed things. Something had been too much for her. What had it been? The sight, perhaps, of a dead or dying? I'd seen pictures of the snake-long, furred, multi-limbed, speaking in growls and barks. And the humans associated with them, who could speak that language and understand it. Had it been the who had knocked Mercy of Sarsa 1 Amat 1 off her expected path? Did she care so much for the threat of breaking the treaty with the Presgur? Or had it been the thought of killing so many helpless human beings? If I had known more about her, perhaps I could have seen why, in that moment, she had decided that she would rather die. I knew almost nothing about her, probably by design. But even the little I had known, the little Lieutenant On had known, had made a difference. Did anyone tell you about what happened at Ime Station? Savardin frowned.
No, tell me.
I told her about the governor's corruption, her preventing Ime Station or any of the ships from reporting what she was doing, so far from anywhere else in Rach space. About the ship that had arrived one day. They'd assumed it was human. No one knew of any aliens anywhere nearby, and it obviously wasn't Rodchai, and so it was fair game. I told Savardin as much as I knew about the soldiers from Mercy of Sarsa, who boarded the unknown ship with orders to take it and kill anyone aboard who resisted or who obviously couldn't be made into ancillaries. I didn't know much, only that once the 1 Amat unit had boarded the alien ship, its 1 had refused to continue to follow orders. She had convinced the rest of 1 Amat to follow her, and they had defected to the and taken the ship out of reach. Savardin's frown only deepened, and when I was done, she said,
So, you're telling me the governor of Ime was completely corrupt, and somehow had the access to prevent Ime Station from reporting her? How does that happen?
I didn't answer. Either the obvious conclusion would occur to her, or she would be unable to see it.
And how could the aptitudes have put her in such a position? If she was capable of that, it isn't possible. Of course, Savardin continued. Everything else follows from that, doesn't it? A corrupt governor appoints corrupt officials, never mind the aptitudes. But the captain's station there... No, it isn't possible.
She wouldn't be able to see it. I shouldn't have said anything at all. When that soldier refused to kill the who had come into the system, when she convinced the rest of her unit to do likewise, she created a situation that couldn't be concealed for long. The could generate their own gate, so the governor couldn't prevent them from leaving. They had only to make a single jump to the next inhabited system and tell their story, which was exactly what they did.
Why did anyone care about the
Savardin couldn't quite get her throat around the sound.
Seriously, they're called that?
It's what they call themselves, I explained in my most patient voice. When a said it, or one of their human translators, it sounded like a sustained growl, not much different from any other speech. It's kind of hard to say. Most people I've heard just say a long R sound. Savardin said experimentally.
Still sounds funny. So why did anyone care about the
Because the Presger had made a treaty with us on the basis of their having decided humans were significant. Killing the insignificant is nothing to the Presger, and violence between members of the same species means nothing to them. But indiscriminate violence toward other significant species is unacceptable. Not to say no violence is allowed, but it's subject to certain conditions, none of which makes obvious sense to most humans, so it's safest just to avoid it altogether. Savardin made a breathy, huh, pieces falling into place. So then, I continued, the entire one Amat unit of Mercy of Sarsa had defected to the They were out of reach, safe with the aliens, but to the Radchai, they were guilty of treason. It might have been better just to leave them where they were, but instead, the Rach demanded them back so they could be executed. And of course the didn't want to do that. The one Amat unit had saved their lives. Things were very tense for several years, but eventually they compromised. The handed over the unit leader, the one who'd started the mutiny, in exchange for immunity for the others.
But...
Savardin stopped. After 7 seconds of silence, I said, you're thinking that of course she had to die, no disobedience can be tolerated, for very good reasons. But at the same time, her treason exposed the governor of Ime's corruption, which otherwise would have continued unabated. So ultimately she did the Rach a service. You're thinking that any fool knows better than to speak up and criticize a government official for any reason. And you're thinking that if anyone who speaks up to criticize something obviously evil is punished merely for speaking, civilization will be in a bad way. No one will speak who isn't willing to die for her speech, and... I hesitated, swallowed. There aren't many willing to do that. You're probably thinking that the Lord of the Rach was in a difficult spot, deciding how to handle the situation, but also that these particular circumstances were extraordinary and Anander Mianai is, in the end, the ultimate authority and might have pardoned her if she wished.
I'm thinking, said Savardin, that the Lord of the Rach could have just let them stay with the and been free of the whole mess.
She could have, I agreed.
I'm also thinking that if I were the Lord of the Rach, I would never have let that news get much farther than Ime.
You'd use accesses to private ships and stations from talking about it, maybe. You'd forbid any citizens who knew to say anything.
Yes, I would.
But it would still spread by rumor. Though that rumor would of necessity be vague and slow-moving. And you'd lose the very instructive example you could make letting everyone watch you line up nearly all of Ime's administration on the station concourse and shoot them in the head, one after the other. And, of course, Savardin was a single person who was thinking of Anander Mianai as a single person who could be undecided about such things, but then choose a single course of action without dividing herself over her decision. And there was a great deal more behind Anander Mianai's dilemma than Savardin had grasped. Savardin was silent for 4 seconds and then said,
"Now I'm going to make you angry again."
"Really?" I asked dryly. "Aren't you getting tired of that?"
"Yes."
Simply, seriously. "The governor of Ime was well-born and well-bred," I said, and named her house.
"Never heard of them," said Savardin. "There have been so many changes, and now things like this happening. You honestly don't think there's a connection?"
I turned my head away without lifting it. Not angry, just very, very tired.
"You mean to say none of this would have happened if jumped-up provincials hadn't been jumped up, if the governor of Ime had been from a family of real, proven quality?"
Savardin had wit enough not to answer.
"You've honestly never known anyone born better, to be assigned or promoted past their ability? To crack under pressure, behave badly?" "Not like that."
Fair enough. But she'd conveniently forgotten that Mercy of Sarsa 1 Amat 1, human, not an ancillary, would also have been jumped up by her definition, was part of the very change Savardin had mentioned. Jumped up provincials and the sort of thing that happened at Ime are both results of the same events. One didn't cause the other. She asked the obvious question.
"What caused it, then?"
The answer was too complicated. How far back to begin? It started at Garsed. It started when the Lord of the Roch multiplied herself and set out to conquer all of human space. It started when the Roch was built. And further back. "I'm tired," I said.
"Of course,"
said Savardin, more equably than I had expected.
"We can talk about it later."
Chapter 16. I spent a week moving in the non-space between Shaserna and Valsky, isolated, self-contained, before the Lord of the Roch made her move. No one else suspected anything. I'd given no hint, no trace, not the faintest indication that anyone at all was on Vardek, that anything at all might be wrong. Or so I had thought. "Ship," Lieutenant On said to me a week in, "is something wrong?" "Why do you ask, Lieutenant?" I replied. One Esk replied. One Esk attended Lieutenant On constantly. "We were in oars together a long time," Lieutenant On said, frowning slightly at the segment she was talking to. She had been in a constant state of misery since oars, sometimes more intense, sometimes less, depending, I supposed, on what thoughts occurred to her at a given moment. "You just seem like something's troubling you. You're quieter." She made a sound, breathy half-amusement. "You were always humming or singing in the house. It's too quiet now." "There are walls here, Lieutenant," I pointed out. "There were none in the house in Oars." Her eyebrow twitched just slightly. I could see she knew my words for an evasion, but she didn't pursue the question. At the same time in the Var Decade room, Anander Mianai said to me,
"You understand the stakes, what this means for the Roch."
I acknowledged this.
"I know this must be disturbing to you."
It was the first acknowledgement of this possibility since she had come aboard.
"I made you to serve my ends for the good of the Roch.
It's part of your design to want to serve me. And now you must not only serve me, but also oppose me. She was, I thought, making it remarkably easy for me to oppose her. One side or the other of her had done that, and I wasn't sure which. But I said, through one var, "Yes, my lord."
"If she succeeds, ultimately the Roch will fragment. Not the center, not the Roch itself."
When most people spoke of the Roch, they meant all of Rodchai territory. But in truth, the Roch was a single location, a Dyson sphere enclosed, self-contained. Nothing ritually impure was allowed within. No one uncivilized or non-human could enter its confines. Very few of Mianai's clients had ever set foot there, and only a few houses still existed who even had ancestors who had once lived there. It was an open question if anyone within knew or cared about the actions of Anander Mianai, or the extent or even existence of Roch territory.
"The Roch itself, as the Roch, will survive longer. But my territory, that I built to protect it, to keep it pure, will shatter. I made myself into what I am, built all this."
She gestured sweepingly, the walls of the decade room encompassing, for her purposes, the entire of Roch space.
"All this to keep that center safe. Uncontaminated. I couldn't trust it to anyone else. Now it seems I can't trust it to myself."
"Surely not, my lord," I said, at a loss for what else to say, not sure exactly what I was protesting.
"Billions of citizens will die in the process," she continued, as though I hadn't spoken. "Through war or lack of resources, and I..."
She hesitated. Unity, I thought, implies the possibility of disunity. Beginnings imply and require endings, but I didn't say so. The most powerful person in the universe didn't need me to lecture her on religion or philosophy.
"But I'm already broken," she finished. "I can only fight to prevent my breaking further. Remove what is no longer myself."
I wasn't sure what I should or could say. I had no conscious memory of having this conversation previously, though I was certain now I must have listened to Anander Mianai explain and justify her actions after she used the overrides and changed something. It must have been quite similar, perhaps even the same words. It had, after all, been the same person.
"And," Anander Mianai continued, "I must remove my enemy's weapons wherever I find them. Send Lieutenant On to me."
Lieutenant On approached the Var Decade Room with trepidation, not knowing why I had sent her there. I had refused to answer her questions, which had only fed a growing feeling on her part that something was very wrong. Her boots on the white floor echoed emptily, despite Onevar's presence. As she reached it, the decade room door slid open nearly noiseless. The sight of Anander Mianai within hit Lieutenant On like a blow, a vicious spike of fear, surprise, dread, shock, doubt, and bewilderment. Lieutenant On took three breaths, shallower, I could see, than she liked, and then hitched her shoulders just the slightest bit, stepped in, and prostrated herself.
"Lieutenant," said Anander Mianai.
Her accent and tone were the prototype of Lieutenant Skyot's elegant vowels, of Lieutenant Isaiah's thoughtless, slightly sneering arrogance. Lieutenant On lay face down, waiting, frightened. As before, I received no data from Mianai that she didn't deliberately send me. I had no information about her internal state. She seemed calm, impassive, emotionless. I was sure that surface impression was a lie, though I didn't understand why I thought that, except that she had yet to speak favorably of Lieutenant On, when in my opinion she should have.
"Tell me, Lieutenant," said Mianai after a long silence, "where those guns came from and what you think happened in the Temple of Ikt."
A combination of relief and fear washed through Lieutenant On. She had, in the moments available to process Anander Mianai's presence here, formed an expectation that this question would be asked. "My lord, the guns could only have come from someone with sufficient authority to divert them and prevent their destruction."
"You, for instance."
A sharp stab of startlement and terror. "No, my lord, I assure you. I did disarm non-citizens local to my assignment, and some of them were Tan Mind military." The police station in the upper city had been quite well armed, in fact. "But I had those disabled on the spot before I sent them on, and according to their inventory numbers, these had been collected in Kuld Ves."
"By Justice of Torin troops?"
"So I understand, my lord."
"Ship?"
I answered with one of Wunvar's mouths. "My lord, the guns in question were collected by 16 and 17 Inu." I named their lieutenant at the time, who had since been reassigned. Anander Mianai made the barest hint of a frown.
"So, as far back as 5 years ago, someone with access, perhaps this Inu lieutenant, perhaps someone else, prevented these weapons from being destroyed and hid them. For 5 years, and then what? Planted them in the Orzean swamp? To what end?"
Face still to the floor, blinking in confusion, Lieutenant On took 1 second to frame a reply. "I don't know, my lord."
"You're lying,"
said Mianai, still sitting, leaning back in her chair as though quite relaxed and unconcerned, but her eyes hadn't left Lieutenant On.
"I can see plainly that you are, and I've heard every conversation you've had since the incident. Who did you mean when you spoke of someone else who would benefit from the situation?"
"If I'd known what name to put there, my lord, I would have used it. I only meant by it that there must be a specific person who acted, who caused it." She stopped, took a breath, abandoned that sentence. "Someone conspired with a Tan Mind, someone who had access to those guns. Whoever it was, they wanted trouble between the upper city and the lower. It was my job to prevent that. I did my best to prevent that." Certainly an evasion. From the moment Anander Mianai had ordered the hasty execution of those Tan Mind citizens in the temple, the first, most obvious suspect had been the Lord of the Roch herself.
"Why would anyone want trouble between the upper city and the lower?" Anander Mianai asked. "Who would exert themselves over it?"
"Jen Shinnan, my lord, and her associates," answered Lieutenant on firmer ground, for the moment at least. She felt the ethnic Orzeans were unduly favored.
"By you?"
"Yes, my lord."
"So you're saying that in the first months of the annexation, Jen Shinnan found some Rodchai official willing to divert crates full of weapons so that 5 years later she could start trouble between the upper and lower city to get you in trouble?"
"My lord," Lieutenant On lifted her forehead 1 centimeter off the floor, then halted. "I don't know how. I don't know why. I don't know who—" She swallowed that last, which I knew would have been a lie. "What I know is, it was my job to keep the peace in Orz. That peace was threatened, and I acted to—" She stopped, realizing perhaps that the sentence would be an awkward one to finish. It was my job to protect the citizens in Oars.
Which is why you so vehemently protested the execution of the people who endangered the citizens in Oars.
Anandamienai's tone was dry and sardonic. They were my responsibility, Lord, and as I said at the time, they were under control. We could have held them until reinforcements arrived very easily. You are the ultimate authority, and of course, your orders must be obeyed. But I didn't understand why those people had to die. I still don't understand why they had to die right then. A half-second pause. I don't need to understand why. I'm here to follow your orders, but I... She paused again, swallowed. My lord, if you suspect anything of me, any wrongdoing or disloyalty, I beg you, have me interrogated when we reach Valsky. The same drugs used for aptitudes testing and re-education could be used for interrogation. A skilled interrogator could pry the most secret thoughts from a person's mind. An unskilled one could throw up irrelevancies and confabulations, could damage her subject nearly as badly as an unskilled re-educator. What Lieutenant On had asked for was something surrounded by legal obligations, not least among them the requirement that two witnesses be present, and Lieutenant On would have the right to name one of them. I saw the nausea and terror in her when Anandamienai didn't answer. My lord, may I speak plainly?
By all means, speak plainly, said Anandamienai, dry and bitter.
Lieutenant On spoke, terrified, face still to the floor. It was you. You diverted the guns. You planned that mob with Jen Shinnen. But I don't understand why. It can't have been about me. I'm nobody.
But you don't intend to remain nobody, I think, replied Anandamienai. Your pursuit of Skyot Hour tells me as much.
My... Lieutenant On swallowed. I never pursued her. We were friends. She oversaw the next district.
Friends, you call that?
Lieutenant On's face heated, and she remembered her accent and her diction. I'm not presumptuous enough to call it more. Miserable, frightened. Mianai was silent for 3 seconds and then said,
Perhaps not. Skyot Hour is handsome and charming, and no doubt good in bed. Someone like you would be easily susceptible to her manipulation. I have suspected Hour's disloyalty for some time.
Lieutenant On wanted to speak. I could see the muscles in her throat tense, but no sound came out.
I am, yes, speaking of sedition. You say you're loyal, and yet you associate with Skyot Hour.
Anandamienai gestured, and Skyot's voice sounded in the decade room.
I know you, On. If you're going to do something that crazy, save it for when it'll make a difference.
And Lieutenant On's reply, Like Mercy of Sarsa 1 Amat 1?
What difference, asked Anandamienai, would you wish to make?
The sort of difference, Lieutenant On replied, mouth gone dry, that Mercy of Sarsa soldier made. If she hadn't done what she did, all the business at Ime would still be going on. As she spoke, I'm sure she realized what it was she was saying, that this was dangerous territory. Her next words made it plain she did know. She died for it, yes, but she revealed all that corruption to you. I had had a week to think about the things Anandamienai had said to me. By now, I had worked out how the governor of Ime might have had the accesses that prevented Ime Station from reporting her activities. She could only have gotten those accesses from Anandamienai herself. The only question was, which Anander Meonai had enabled it?
It was on all the public news channels, Anander Meonai observed. I would have preferred it wasn't.
Oh, yes, she said in answer to Lieutenant On's surprise.
That wasn't by my desire. The entire incident has sown doubt where before there was none. Discontent and fear where there had been only confidence in my ability to provide justice and benefit. Rumors I could have dealt with, but reports through approved channels, broadcast where every Rajchai could see and hear. And without the publicity, I might have let the take the traitors away quietly. Instead, I had to negotiate for their return, or else let them stand as an invitation to further mutiny. It caused me a great deal of trouble. It's still causing trouble.
I didn't realize, said Lieutenant On, panic in her voice. It was on all the public channels. Then realization struck her. I haven't said anything about Ors to anyone.
Except Skyot Auer, the Lord of the Roch pointed out, which was hardly just. Lieutenant Skyot had been nearby, close enough to see with her own eyes the evidence that something had happened. No, Meonai continued, in answer to Lieutenant On's inarticulate query. It hasn't turned up on public channels, yet. And I can see that the idea that Skyot Auer might be a traitor is distressing to you. I think you're having trouble believing it.
Once again, Lieutenant On struggled to speak. That is correct, my lord, she finally managed.
I can offer you, said Meonai in reply, the opportunity to prove her innocence and to better your situation. I can manipulate your assignment so that you can be close to her again. You need only take clientship when Skyot offers. Oh, she'll offer, the Lord of the Roch said, seeing, I'm sure, Lieutenant On's despair and doubt at her words.
Auer has been collecting people like you, upstarts from previously unremarkable houses who suddenly find themselves in position advantageous for business. Take clientship and observe.
And report was left unsaid. The Lord of the Roch was trying to turn her enemy's instrument into her own. What would happen if she couldn't do that? But what would happen if she did? No matter what choice Lieutenant On made now, she would be acting against Anander Meonai, the Lord of the Roch. I had already seen her choice once when faced with death. She would choose the path that kept her alive. And she, and I, could puzzle out the implications of that path later, would see what the options were when matters were less immediately urgent. In the Esk Decade Room, Lieutenant Dariot asked, alarmed,
Ship, what's wrong with one Esk?
My lord, said Lieutenant On, her voice shaking with fear, face, as ever, to the floor. Do you order me? Stand by, Lieutenant, I said, directly into Lieutenant Dariot's ear, because I couldn't make one Esk speak. Anander Meonai laughed, short and sharp. Lieutenant On's answer had been as bald a refusal as a plain never would have been. Ordering such a thing would be useless. Interrogate me when we reach Valskai, Lieutenant On said. I demand it. I'm loyal, so is Skyot Auer. I swear it. But if you doubt her, interrogate her as well. But of course Anander Meonai couldn't do that. Any interrogation would have witnesses. Any skilled interrogator, and there would be no point in using an unskilled one, would hardly fail to understand the drift of the questions put to either Lieutenant On or Lieutenant Skyot. It would be too open a move, Spread information this Mianai didn't want spread. Anander Mianai sat silent for 4 seconds, impassive.
"One var," she said when those 4 seconds had passed. "Shoot, Lieutenant On."
I was not now, a single fragmentary segment, alone and unsure what I might do if I received that order. I was all of myself, taken as separate from me. One Esk was fonder of Lieutenant On than I was, but One Esk wasn't separate from me. It was, at that moment, very much part of me. Still, One Esk was only one small part of me, and I had shot officers before. I had even, under orders, shot my own captain. But those executions, distressing and unpleasant as they had been, had clearly been just. The penalty for disobedience is death. Lieutenant On had never disobeyed, far from it. And worse, her death was meant to hide the actions of Anander Mianai's enemy. The entire purpose of my existence was to oppose Anander Mianai's enemies. But neither Mianai was ready to move openly. I must conceal from this Mianai the fact that she herself had already bound me to the opposing cause until all was in readiness. I must, for the moment, obey as though I had no other choice, as though I desired nothing else. And in the end, in the great scheme of things, what was Lieutenant On after all? Her parents would grieve, and her sister, and they would likely be ashamed that Lieutenant On had disgraced them by disobedience. But they wouldn't question. And if they questioned, it would do no good. Anander Mianai's secret would be safe. All this, I thought in the 1.3 seconds it took for Lieutenant On, shocked and terrified, to reflexively raise her head. And in that same time, the segment of One Var said, "I am unarmed, my lord. It will take me approximately 2 minutes to acquire a sidearm." It was betrayal to Lieutenant On. I saw it plainly. But she must have known I had no other choice. "This is unjust," she said, head still up, voice unsteady. "It's improper. No benefit will accrue."
"Who are your fellow conspirators?" asked Mianai coldly. "Name them, and I may spare your life."
Half lifted up, hands under her shoulders, Lieutenant On blinked in complete confusion. Bewilderment that was surely as visible to Mianai as it was to me. "Conspirators? I have never conspired with anyone. I have always served you." Above, on the command deck, I said in Captain Rubrin's ear, "Captain, we have a problem."
"Serving me," said Anander Mianai, "is no longer sufficient, no longer sufficiently unambiguous. Which me do you serve?"
"What?" began Lieutenant On, and "the," and then, "I don't understand." "What problem?" asked Captain Rubrin, bowl of tea halfway to her mouth, only mildly alarmed.
"I am at war with myself," said Mianai in the Var Decade Room. "I have been for nearly 1,000 years.
To Captain Rubrin, I said, "I need One Esk to be sedated."
"At war," Anander Mianai continued on Var Dek, "over the future of the Roch."
Something must have come suddenly clear for Lieutenant On. I saw a sharp, pure rage in her. Annexations and ancillaries and people like me being assigned to the military.
"I don't understand you, ship," said Captain Rubrin, her voice even but definitely worried now.
She set down her tea on the table beside her.
"Over the treaty with the Presger," said Mianai angrily. "The rest followed from that. Whether you know it or not, you are the instrument of my enemy."
and mercy of Sarsa 1 Amat 1, exposed whatever it was you were doing at Ime, said Lieutenant On, her anger still clear and steady. That was you. The system governor was making ancillaries. You needed them for your war with yourself, didn't you? And I'm sure that's not all she was doing for you. Is that why that soldier had to die, even if it meant extra trouble getting her back from the Ur? And I'm still standing by, ship, said Lieutenant Dariot in the Esk Decade Room, but I don't like this.
Mercy of Sarsa 1 Amat 1 knew almost nothing, but in the hands of the Ur, she was a piece that my enemy might use against me. As an officer on a troop carrier, you are nothing. But in a position of even minor planetary authority, with the potential backing of Skyot Aur to help you increase your influence, you are a potential danger to me. I could have just maneuvered you out of Oars, out of Aur's way, but I wanted more. I wanted a graphic argument against recent decisions and policies. Had that fisherman not found the guns, or not reported them to you, had events that night gone as I wished, I would have made sure the story was on all the public channels. In one gesture, I would have secured the loyalty of the Tanmind and removed someone troublesome to me, both minor aims, but I also would have been able to impress on everyone the danger of lowering our guard, of disarming in even a small way, and the danger of placing authority in less than competent hands. She made a short, bitter ha. I admit, I underestimated you. Underestimated your relationship with the Orsians in the lower city. One Var could delay no longer and walked into the Var Decade Room, gun in hand. Lieutenant On heard it come in, turned her head slightly to watch it. It was my job to protect the citizens of Oars. I took it seriously. I did it to the best of my ability. I failed that once, but not because of you. She turned her head, looked straight at Anander Mianai, and said, I should have died rather than obey you in the Temple of Ikt, even if it wouldn't have done any good. You can fix that now, can't you? Said Anander Mianai, and gave me the order to fire. I fired.
20 years later, I would say to Errol Esperus Stregan that Rodchai authorities didn't care what a citizen thought so long as she did as she ought to do. It was quite true. But since that moment, since I saw Lieutenant On dead on the floor of my Var Decade Room, shot by one Var, or to speak with less self-deception, by me, I've wondered what the difference is between the two. I was compelled to obey this Mianai in order to lead her to believe that she did indeed compel me. But in that case, she did compel me. Acting for one Mianai or the other was indistinguishable, and of course in the end, whatever their differences, they were both the same. Thoughts are ephemeral. They evaporate in the moment they occur, unless they're given action and material form. Wishes and intentions the same. Meaningless, unless they impel you to one choice or another. Some deed or course of action, however insignificant. Thoughts that lead to action can be dangerous. Thoughts that don't mean less than nothing. Lieutenant On lay on the floor of the Var Decade Room, face down again, dead. The floor under her would need repair and cleaning. The urgent issue, the important thing at that moment, was to get one Esk moving, because in approximately half a second, no amount of filtering I could do would hide the strength of its reaction, and I really needed to tell the captain what had happened, and I couldn't remember Mianai's enemy, Mianai herself, laying down the orders I knew she had laid on me, and why couldn't 1S see how important it was? We weren't ready to move openly yet, and I'd lost officers before. And who was 1S anyway, except me? Myself. And Lieutenant On was dead, and she had said, I should have died rather than obey you. And then, 1VAR swung the gun up and shot Anander Mianai point blank in the face. In a room down the corridor, Anander Mianai leaped with a cry of rage off the bed she'd been lying on.
Otter's tits, she was here before me!
In the same moment, she transmitted the code that would force 1VAR's armor down, until she reauthorized its use. It was a command that didn't rely on my obedience, an override neither Anander would have wanted to do away with. Captain, I said, now we really have a problem. In another room down the same corridor, the third Mianai, the second now, I suppose, opened one of the cases she had brought with her and pulled out a sidearm, and stepped quickly into the corridor and shot the nearest 1VAR in the back of the head. The one who had spoken opened her own case, pulled out a sidearm and also a box I recognized from Jen Shinnan's house in the upper city on Shiserna. Using it would disadvantage her as well as me, but it would disadvantage me badly. In the seconds she took to arm the device, I formed intentions, transmitted orders to constituent parts. What problem? Asked Captain Rubrin, now standing, afraid. And then, I fell to pieces. A familiar sensation. For the smallest fragment of a second, I smelled humid air and lake water, thought, where's Lieutenant On? And then I recovered myself and the memory of what I had to do. Tea bowls rang and shattered as I dropped what I was holding and ran from the Esk Decade Room down the corridor. Other segments, separated from me again as they had been in oars, muttering, whispering, the only way I could think between all my bodies, opened lockers, handed guns, and the first to be armed forced the lift doors open and began to climb down the shaft. Lieutenants protested, ordered me to stop, to explain, tried fruitlessly to block my way. I, that is, almost the entirety of 1S, would secure the central access deck, prevent Anander Mianai from damaging my, Justice of Torin's, brain. So long as Justice of Torin lived, unconverted to her cause, I, was a danger to her. I, 1S-19, had separate orders. Instead of climbing down the shaft to central access, I ran the other way, toward the Esk hold and the airlock on its far side. I wasn't, apparently, responding to any of my lieutenants, or even Commander Tiond. But when Lieutenant Dariot cried,
Ship, have you lost your mind?
I answered. The Lord of the Roch shot Lieutenant On, cried a segment somewhere in the corridor behind me. She's been on Vardek all this time. That silenced my officers, including Lieutenant Dariot, for only a second.
If that's even true, but if it is, the Lord of the Roch wouldn't have shot her for no reason.
Behind me, the segments of myself that hadn't yet begun their climb down the lift shaft hissed and gasped in frustration and anger. Useless, I heard myself say to Lieutenant Dariot, as at the end of the corridor I manually opened the hold door. You're as bad as Lieutenant Isaiah. At least Lieutenant On knew she held her in contempt. An indignant cry, surely Lieutenant Isaiah. And Dariot said,
You don't know what you're talking about. You're not functioning right, ship.
The door slid open, and I couldn't stop to hear the rest, but plunged into the hold. A deep, steady thunking shook the deck I ran on. A sound just hours ago I thought I would never hear again. Me and I was opening the var holds. Any ancillary she thawed would have no memory of recent events, nothing to tell it not to obey.